Hello, Mare people. Welcome to the Time Turner Harry Potter In-Depth. Per usual, we're doing an in-depth analysis of what happened in each set of chapters and looking for ties to the endgame, foreshadowing, anything special we want to talk about, and hot takes or big questions that we have. Today, we're going over chapters 25 through 27 of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. And heads up, this is a podcast for grown-ups. But first, Ken needs to channel his inner Professor Binns and remind us what happened in Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, chapters 22 through 24.
Harry and Ron agonize over getting a date for the Yule Ball. Harry finally builds up the courage to ask Cho, but she's already going with Cedric. After Ron's failed attempt to ask his future sister-in-law goes badly, he tries to settle and go with Hermione. But Hermione is going with a mystery date and does not appreciate being Ron's date of last resort. Harry makes plans to go with Parvati Patel, and her sister Padma agrees to go with Ron. Harry uses the ball as an excuse to procrastinate and not work on understanding the egg, the key to the second Triwizard task. At the ball, we find out that Hermione is going with Victor Krum. Dumbledore gives us our first hint about the Room of Requirements. Harry and Ron are altogether awful dates, and Ron's anger over Hermione going to the ball with Krum leads to a massive fight between the two. Harry overhears Fred and George unsuccessfully try to talk with Ludo Bagman. He also overhears Snape and Karkaroff discuss something getting stronger, as well as Hagrid telling Madame Maxime that he is a half-giant. Cedric gives Harry some advice to try and listen to the egg while taking a bath. Rita Skeeter writes an article about Hagrid being a half-giant, and it takes the combined efforts of Dumbledore, Harry, Ron, and Hermione to convince Hagrid not to resign. It's time. Let's grab our firebolts and dodge some bludgers as we work through who scored and who fell off their broom in chapters 25 to 27 of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire.
Chapter 25. Harry sneaks out to go work on the egg and the prefix bath, and he brings the map, the invisibility cloak, and of course, the egg. The bathroom sounds dope. It is like a really, really cool, fancy bathroom.
Yeah, I 100% want to take a bath there.
Yeah, yeah. Even like the password, I think it was Pine Fresh. I mean, it sounds like it smells good. This is a really cool bathroom. I mean, no 14-year-old, 15-year-old needs this bathroom. I need this bathroom.
They have a diving board in the bathroom. How cool is that?
Yeah. So Harry had fun, you know, exploring the bathroom for a while, and he finally decides, okay, I should probably open the egg, and he opens the egg, and it screamed crazy again. But then Moaning Myrtle shows up and tells Harry, I'd try putting it in the water if I were you. Harry's very concerned because Myrtle was there and he's naked and he doesn't like that. But it turns out she watched Cedric bring the egg into the bathroom, although Harry is very honored because Myrtle apparently did not go out to say anything to Cedric. He then opens the egg under the water and he hears a chorus of voices, a song. And I'm not going to repeat the whole song, but he does work with Myrtle to figure out the puzzle of what the next task is. Harry realizes upon figuring all this out that this is all very bad news because it appears Harry's going to have to go underwater to get something that he is going to miss. And just on practicalities alone, he's not a very good swimmer. He, of course, then realized there's one bigger problem besides not being a strong swimmer. How's he supposed to breathe? He can't breathe. Very stupid that Harry made this comment in front of Myrtle tactless, and she was devastated. How could you talk about breathing in front of me?
I'm going to go ahead and disagree with you on that one. I don't think it's stupid. I think he's thinking out loud and like, yeah, he addressed it to Myrtle, but he's really just, you know, thinking what's coming to his mind. He's not actually expecting her to present an answer. So I don't think this is stupid. I think she took it badly, understandably, and that's Moaning Myrtle for you. But I don't think he had any ill intentions or any stupidity for saying this out loud.
No, it's silly.
We'd all do it. You'd say it out loud too.
Right. Huh. How am I supposed to breathe? Yes, no, I agree.
Right.
Just a fun fact. Our mother always told me if I was going to play a Harry Potter character in the movie, it would be Myrtle.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I think she's probably right.
I'll leave that one there.
Yeah, thank you. Harry figures the puzzle out, leaves Myrtle, and he goes to sneak back. He's looking at the map, and he sees something strange. He sees Bartimaeus?
Bartimaeus?
Can I just call him Barty for the purposes of the podcast?
Yeah.
Barty Crouch in Snape's office. And Harry, well, he's Harry, so he can't just ignore it. He has to go investigate. That's dumb.
Yeah, okay, that's dumb. Yes.
Right? We can agree that this was yes. Stupid. Okay.
He's stupid.
Fine. So in his stupidity, he gets stuck in a trick step and the egg went flying. His invisibility cloak slipped and he was able to grab it. But as he was grabbing it, he let go of the map, which flew away, and he couldn't wipe it blank in time. And then he hears Filch coming. Harry's very concerned here because he's invisible, sure, but the map will certainly say Harry Potter. So he's not sure how he's going to get out of this one. Filch finds the egg first, very excited about finding evidence of Peeves' bad behavior. But for Harry, things get worse very quickly because Snape shows up and Snape heard the ruckus. So he says he came out to investigate the noise and he saw, based on some clues, you know, the light or whatever, that someone was in his office and Harry is internally freaking out. What is he going to do? Then Mad-Eye shows up. Mad-Eye Moody. Fake Mad-Eye Moody. We're just going to call him Mad-Eye.
Spoiler.
Yeah, right. Spoiler. Okay.
Yeah.
Filch was about to explain to Mad-Eye that Snape thinks someone broke into his office, but Snape doesn't want Filch to tell that to Mad-Eye, but it's too late. There is a lot of talk between these three. Mad-Eye questions Snape. It's apparent that Mad-Eye has previously searched Snape's office. Mad-Eye explains it's his privilege as an Auror. Snape is like, no way Dumbledore allowed it. He trusts me. Mad-Eye is waffly on that one and says some spots never come off. Snape then seizes his left forearm as though something had hurt him. Mad-Eye tells Snape to go back to bed, and then they both see the map, which just looks like a parchment. Harry takes a big gamble here, and he waves frantically at Mad-Eye with his arms. That's his. It's his. Mad-Eye is able to get it out of Snape's hand just in time, but Snape does recognize the parchment and starts wildly accusing Harry. It's Potter's egg. It's Potter's parchment. Potter's here. He's under the invisibility cloak. Snape's groping around, trying to find Harry, and Mad-Eye shouts at him that there's nothing there, but he's gonna tell Dumbledore how fast Snape's mind jumped to Potter. Snape backpedals. Ultimately, Mad-Eye saves Harry out of this whole thing. He gets the egg back. He gets Snape to go back to bed. He does ask Harry about the map, which Harry explains, and he tells Mad-Eye that it was Barty Crouch searching Snape's office. Moody tells Harry that Barty Crouch is obsessed with catching dark wizards and weird stuff is going on. He also asks Harry if he can borrow the map, and Harry reluctantly agrees because it's better than him confiscating the map or being in trouble for the map. And Moody ends this conversation with telling Harry to consider a career as an Auror.
Chapter 26. Harry recaps what he witnessed to Ron and Hermione, letting them know about Moody and Snape arguing and everything that transpired. Ron suggests that Snape put Harry's name in the goblet, but Hermione shoots it down. This is example number 513 of one of them thinks Snape is a bad guy, and Hermione says, we've thought this before, and Dumbledore trusts him, so I trust him. There will be more examples as we continue. Harry continues to struggle to find a way to breathe underwater, but in good news for them, Hagrid's back teaching care of magical creatures, and he proves to know just as much about unicorns as he does dangerous animals, which is just kind of a nice way of showing us that Hagrid actually is probably really good at his job. He does have the knowledge required, and he can be a good teacher when he's not worried about just showing them dangerous things. Harry lies to Hagrid again, saying that he knows what he's going to do for the second task, even though he still has no idea how to actually breathe underwater. By the evening of the second task, nothing has changed. Harry, Ron, and Hermione have been scourging through books and trying to find any answer, and they've got nothing. Hermione and Ron are called to McGonagall's office, leaving Harry to do the searching on his own. As he's studying and trying to find a solution, Harry falls asleep, and he's woken up by Dobby 10 minutes before the second task is set to begin. Dobby tells Harry that he's going to have to rescue Ron and gives him Gillyweed, a plant that Dobby says will let Harry breathe underwater. Harry arrives at the second task just in time, but still there's enough time for Percy to tell Harry off for being late. And I know that, you know, we have a Percy lover on this podcast, but shut up, Percy. He doesn't need that. He's there. He got there in time. He doesn't need you giving him crap.
You like being punctual just as much as I do.
I'm all for being punctual, and I would be very furious at Harry, like, if this was, you know, something I had control over. But why does it impact Percy that Harry's late? Do we even know if he's rooting for him? Not the point. Harry takes the gillyweed, and after freaking out for a moment because it doesn't seem to be working, it gives Harry gills. You know, it's kind of in the name, kind of obvious.
Ouch!
So he has the ability to breathe underwater. Yeah, ouch. Sounds painful. Harry escapes some Grindelows, and Moaning Myrtle helps direct him through the lake to find Ron. Harry reaches the mer people and finds Ron, Hermione, Cho Chang, and a young girl who he correctly deduces is Fleur's younger sister, Gabrielle.
Brilliant, Harry. Brilliant.
Just another example of sometimes Harry actually can be good at deduction and actually shows the ability to...
Good at deduction.
Yeah, sometimes he...
How hard is that to figure out?
I don't know. He's 14.
I'm just saying, it's not like that's a stretch, right?
It's someone he's never met before, and he's like, oh, this is Fleur's sister. Like, okay, you know what? In the moment, that might not have come to you.
I'm just saying, you might be giving him, like, a little more credit.
Here's my thing. I think that I rightly, because of course rightly, give Harry and everyone else in this series a lot of crap all the time. And very often, we make a point to call them out for silly, stupid things. So every now and then, I think I can give them some credit that maybe is a little over the top to even it out. Don't want anyone to think I'm too negative here.
Right. Fair enough.
So Harry, after some initial difficulty, cuts Ron loose. But then, fearing the safety of the other people, because he was told that they have an hour to rescue their friend slash loved one, and none of the other champions have shown up yet, begins to try to figure out if he can free all the other people that were taken. The mer people are not liking this, though. Cedric arrives and takes Cho Chang, followed quickly by Crumb, who shows up and frees Hermione. As these two go to the surface, Harry realizes that Fleur still has not shown up and decides that he needs to free Gabrielle, or else she will drown. Harry eventually reaches the surface with both Ron and Gabrielle, just as the gillyweed wears off. Once they're back and Ron is now awake, he gives Harry crap for believing that Gabrielle needs to be rescued out loud. You know, Ron essentially calls Harry out for saying, you really believe that Dumbledore would have let us die if someone didn't rescue us in time? That makes no sense. Like, of course they were going to be fine.
We're going to talk more about this later, right?
Yes. Yeah, there's going to be more on this. I have a lot of thoughts.
Oh, good.
Once they're back on dry land, we see Crumb talking with Hermione and pulls a beetle out of her hair. It seems innocent, right? Nothing we need to worry about, Alyssa?
Nothing at all. No reason that that's in there.
This beetle won't come back.
Right.
No, just a random little piece of trivia. After having been unable to complete the task, Fleur gains a lot of respect for Harry for having stayed below the water to rescue Gabrielle as well, and starts to see Harry both as a more equal competitor and as actually a good person. The days of Fleur, you know, treating Harry like a servant when they announced the champions is gone.
Oh, are you here to bring me a message?
Yeah, we don't need to go through that again. We get the judges' score, and even though Cedric and Victor Crumb returned before Harry, the judges, minus Karkaroff, give Harry extra points for trying to rescue everyone, not just Ron. Which means that at the end of the second task, and with just one more task to go, Cedric is tied for first place with Harry. We have a nice Hogwarts tie in first.
Lovely. Go Hogwarts.
Go Hogwarts. Go Hufflepuffs. Like, this is all written from Harry's perspective, but let's be serious. I'm rooting for Cedric this entire time.
Yeah, my Slytherins are not having a good time.
No. I guess you guys root for Cedric, but, like, are you happy about that?
I mean, we're happy that it's not Harry, I guess. That's what it would traditionally be.
Yeah. Check out the Is This Entertainment podcast. Jacob and Ben, two self-described hermits that play music together, have episodes about the music they're listening to and the TV shows and movies they're watching. Recently, they recapped the last season of The Mandalorian and are currently reviewing episodes of WandaVision. Is this entertaining? They're not sure, but they're having fun doing it. Please give the Is This Entertainment podcast a listen on your favorite podcast app or on isthisentertainment.com.
Chapter 27. Ron is being a ham with the retelling of the water rescue story, and Harry's indulging it because Ron doesn't really get a chance to be in the spotlight very much. Harry is always in the spotlight, and he's more than happy to share with Ron. Hermione, though, is being teased about being Victor Crumb's thing you'd miss the most, and she snaps at Ron's exaggeration of the story, which kind of puts Ron back on track. Sirius sends a note, very short, telling Harry to be in a place in Hogsmeade at 2 on Saturday, which is a Hogsmeade day, and to bring food, which was concerning, but they, you know, read it and said, okay, moved on. Then, big gossip of the day, not even just at Hogwarts, probably all around the Wizarding Britain, a Witches Weekly article comes out about how Harry and Hermione are in love, and the school is just abuzz with this, and Harry and Hermione are annoyed, but Hermione is very above it all. Ron is aghast. How can you let them say that? You're painting you like a scarlet woman, which we thought was a very funny thing to say. But Hermione is much more focused on how Rita knew that Victor asked Hermione to visit him over the summer, which of course Ron didn't like because he's very jealous. And as they get to their next class, which is of course potions, Snape, because he's a dick, reads the article to the entire class.
What an awful move.
Yeah, just total dick. Snape accuses Harry also of breaking into his office, which, funny enough, is actually not true by some miracle, right? Harry did not break into Snape's office this year. Even in previous years, I don't think he ever did.
It's one of the few times where he actually doesn't have to lie to Snape about rule breaking. He didn't do it. Like, Dobby broke in for him, maybe, but that's not the same thing.
But I think Harry, being who Harry is, probably wishes it was him because he thinks he knows who it is. He's like, it's Dobby and it's Hermione and oh my god, they're gonna get in trouble. And to Harry, that could be worse than it being him.
Yeah, more on that later. I have some thoughts that I want to talk about in our next section about this interaction.
Okay, let's table that. Snape threatens Harry with a new potion, Veritaserum, a truth potion, which Harry does not like. He is not into this. And just like we were mentioning before, he's not particularly worried about him finding out he broke into Snape's office, which he didn't, but all the other things he knows, like everybody else that broke into Snape's office and Sirius. And then he thinks about Cho and his feelings. What a teenage boy. Karkaroff then comes in and is insistent to talk to Snape. Snape is saying after class, and he clearly doesn't want to see Karkaroff. Karkaroff corners him and shows Snape something on his inner forearm. Says it hasn't been this clear since, and then Snape yells at him, tells him to put it away. Snape realizes Harry's there and kicks Harry out. Obviously, now we know what that is, but at the time, very confusing. We get to Hogsmeade Day. The trio goes out to Hogsmeade. They stop to buy Dobby some socks as a thank you, which is very nice. Then they go to the meetup point where Sirius told them to go, and they see Sirius in dog form and Buckbeak. Sirius transforms into his human form, and he is so into the chicken legs that Harry brought him. He says he's been living off rats, which is really sad.
Awful.
Sirius is concerned about the goings-on and felt like he had to come back. They talk about Crouch a bit, and Hermione explains to Sirius what happened with Winky, the weird chain of events at the World Cup with the wand and the dark mark, etc. They talk a little bit about Ludo Bagman, but Sirius doesn't seem to know anything about him. And Hermione is kvetching about how Crouch treated Winky and fired him. And Ron is like, enough! We know how you feel about house elves. But Sirius says, no, actually, she has a good point. And this is a pretty poignant line, which I guess it's not uncommon as adults, but when you're reading this as a preteen, I think it's a nice thing to hear. If you want to know what a man's like, take a good look at how he treats his inferiors, not his equals. Sirius then explains what he knows about Barty Crouch. He's a workaholic, was the head of magical law enforcement. He was the one that sent Sirius to Azkaban without a trial. Sirius explains that Crouch was tipped to be the next Minister of Magic. He was super power hungry, never a Voldemort supporter, was rising up during this kind of crazy period of capturing these Death Eaters and Voldemort at large, but he was very ruthless, not with the good side, but he was very ruthless with the bad side. It sort of seems like a lack of due process type of stuff. Then Barty Crouch's son was caught with a group of Death Eaters. Sirius says he has no idea if the son was actually a Death Eater, but Barty Crouch had a tiny bit of decency to allow his son a trial, but he sent him right into the Dementors at Azkaban. Then the son died about a year later. Crouch's wife died shortly after that, and Crouch essentially lost it all and was shuffled to the International Magical Cooperation, which I think sounds really cool, but I guess that's a step down from Minister of Magic.
Yeah, right. It's one of those, like, you and me were like, oh, that sounds awesome. Like, we get to, like, run the Triwizard Tournament and help set up the Quidditch World Cup, but, like...
Like, diplomacy.
Right, but for someone who wants to be the mayor, I guess it's not exactly as good.
Yeah, I'd rather be the Secretary of State than the mayor of city, but okay, who am I?
Right.
So, the group then discusses Snape. And, you know, the typical back and forth, Hermione, you know, Dumbledore trusts him. And it's interesting to hear Sirius's kind of first perspective on Snape, because we really never talked about it with Sirius before. He explained how everyone that Snape hung out with in school did turn out to be Death Eaters. He doesn't seem to know much more about that. Harry explained to Sirius what he saw with Karkaroff and the forearm. But Sirius didn't know what that was about. He seemed much more concerned with Crouch. We'll get to this later, I think. After they leave Sirius, the group, Harry, Hermione, and Ron, they discuss Percy, whether they think he would know anything about Crouch. And the question kind of comes up, would Percy throw his family to the Dementors? Which Hermione was like, of course not. And Ron was like, I don't know, he's pretty ambitious. But the chapter and the segment ends with a nice but sad line from Ron, which we already expressed our sentiments, which is, poor old Snuffles, he must really like you, Harry, imagining having to live off rats. So with that, let's stir the cauldron and sip on some tea. What are our big questions or hot takes for chapters 25 through 27 of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire?
So I'll start by saying that I think we actually have a lot here, at least in our notes, so we'll see how much we get through. But I'll start with the first one that we have here, which is, so Mad-Eye Moody takes the Marauder's Map from Harry. Is he doing this so that Harry wouldn't realize that he's not actually Mad-Eye Moody? Is there something else going on? What do you think?
I think it has to be that, in hindsight. I mean, the immediate concern would be Harry looks at that and sees that he's talking to Barty Crouch, right? Barty Crouch Jr. So I think there's that, like, immediate, I have to get this out of Harry's hands. And I think it was done really subtly by Moody. Because if he expressed any more interest than, can I borrow it? I think Harry would have been concerned. But the very casual, do you mind if I take this? This is really interesting. After getting him out of a bind, that was super smart. But I also think long-term, again, had to happen because he's plotting all his stuff. He needs to see what's going on.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's both of those as well. I think you hit the nail on the head on both accounts that he needs to make sure that Harry doesn't find his identity, but also that, you know, we find out that he's on the lookout for his father to know if Barty Crouch Sr. comes back to Hogwarts. And also, he might need to steal supplies from Snape again, in which case he needs to make sure that Snape or anyone else is not gonna sneak up on him when he's sneaking around the castle. So I think there's short-term and long-term considerations going on here.
Right. I agree completely.
So on a similar note, and a similar portion of the chapters, I'm a little confused, which is not something I feel like I admit very often, but I'm confused by the spell Snape uses to seal his office. You know, he's like, oh, I seal my office with a spell only a wizard could break, but it's simple enough that he thinks that Harry might have been the one to break it. So I guess my first question is, like, why not just use a more complex, advanced spell that Harry wouldn't be able to break? But I also, though, wonder if maybe it's not that end. He was kind of coming up with a lie to Moody at the time. It was like, oh, I think, you know, a student must have broken in. And then when he realized Harry was in the area, he was like, that must be it. Like, he started to believe his own lie. Harry broke into my closet, even though, like, he probably, if he thought about it, would have realized that Harry doesn't have the magical ability to break Snape's spells.
Yeah, or maybe he doesn't think Harry has the ability, but I think he does have a begrudging kind of respect for Hermione, and he knows Harry doesn't do anything alone. So I don't necessarily disagree with you, but I think it's possible he did do something complex, but thinks Harry found a way around it.
And that Hermione might have done it. Okay, that's fair. Yeah, this is one of those instances, and I think there's other ones in these chapters even that it's like, I feel like if people gave this a little more thought, they would kind of realize what's going on here. But, you know, that's also being approached with having read the book so many times that I know exactly what's actually going on.
Right.
So who am I to judge?
Right, I agree. It's very hard. That one's a hard one. So I have a question, and it's not like a big one, but it's a little one. It's about the movie, and I have a lot of strong feelings about the changes, especially in this book, from book to movie. But let's pick on a little one. In the movie, Neville tells Harry about the Gillyweed, not Dobby. But Dobby is a character in the movie, so it's not like it's Winky. Winky is not a character at all.
Dobby's not either.
Dobby is a character in the movies, not this one.
In the movies, yeah. Yeah, he's not in Goblet of Fire at all.
No, I agree, but it's not like they'd have to introduce Dobby as a character, really. Like the way they would Ludo Bagman or Winky or whatever. Is it like CGI cost? Like, did Harry Potter have a budget? Like, it seems like, why would they make that change? I loved it being Dobby.
Yeah, so I mean, I agree with you that it's not a great change. I think it's probably a cost thing as well, but also I think you can't just do Dobby for this one scene. If you're going to have Dobby be the one that does this, you also need to do the scene where they go to the kitchens and talk with Dobby about being a free elf and getting paid by Dumbledore. And then, you know, if you do that, how can you then not bring in Winky in and do all that stuff? So I think it's one of those things where they probably looked at it and said it would require multiple scenes and probably a lot of CGI because you have to do a lot more things and you can't just have Dobby show up for 10 seconds to do this. So I think it was cost-cutting.
That's fair, but I wish it was Dobby.
I agree. I love that it's Dobby, and it's a shame. We've talked about this before. It's a shame that he's not in this movie at all.
And I liked that in the book, we obviously find out later, but I liked that Mad-Eye had planted the book on Gillyweed's on Neville, like, forever ago. And I liked the complexity of Harry never asking him. Like, that's a Harry Potter character flaw. He'll ask for help, but, like, to Hermione and Ron, he won't ask all his friends, and that was something that fake Mad-Eye didn't understand about him. That just planting it on anybody wouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that an interesting thing to think about, especially when you consider Neville's character growth. I don't like how rude Harry was to Neville in the movies. I just have a big problem with all this. I liked it better in the books.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And, you know, I think the way that, first of all, Neville's dealt with in the movies in general, but also how, you know, Harry, Ron, and Hermione deal with Neville throughout the books are both problematic. But your other point also is right, that one of the best things that Crouch Jr. says to Harry at the end is about how he was too stubborn to ask everyone for help. And it was this genius plan to plant the book with Neville right at the beginning and expect Harry to ask his bunkmate. But on a similar note, you know, we get in these chapters that Hagrid again asks Harry, like, you ready? You know what you're going to do? And Harry's like, yeah, I know what I'm going to do. And has this thought, he's like, should I ask Hagrid how to breathe underwater? He must know, but then doesn't. And on my reread, I'm looking at this going, you absolutely should have. Hagrid already broke all the rules of the tournament to show you the dragons. It's not like he's going to turn you in for asking for help. Like, yeah, you ask Hagrid how to breathe underwater. That seems like one of the simplest things you could do here. And I don't understand Harry not bringing him in. I guess it's this stubborn thing we're talking about, but like, there's even a difference between asking Hagrid and Neville. And I think you got to ask Hagrid.
Okay, I have a slightly different take on this. And I don't know if it's because I over-romanticize Harry's character. I'm one of those like very pro-Harry people. I like his character a lot. I sort of read it, or I've been reading it as an adult, as I don't think Harry ever thought Hagrid would have turned him in. I think it was sort of the reverse, that Harry doesn't want to implicate Hagrid. What if someone found out that Hagrid did it? He already took a huge risk for the dragons. Hagrid cannot talk his way out of trouble the way that Harry can. And Harry is not particularly good at talking himself out of trouble. Hagrid's worse, right? I sort of view it as a mark of friendship that Harry doesn't do that and doesn't put Hagrid in a position of even having to say, oh, I shouldn't, I'm a teacher.
That's fair. I mean, I think part of it also is that Harry's been lying to Hagrid and saying he knows what he's doing and he doesn't want to disappoint his friend and be like, actually, I have no clue what to do. But it's funny you brought up, you know, Harry's ability or lack of ability to get out of tight situations, because Harry thinks he's really good at it. Like, in a later book, he compares himself to Tom Riddle when Riddle's, you know, very subtly convincing Slughorn to do what he wants. And Harry's like, oh, as someone who's done this tons of times, I see a master at work. It's like, Harry, you're not good at it.
Well, I beg to disagree. I actually think that line in the sixth book was like, he's not good at it. And he recognizes that Tom Riddle is really good at it.
No, but I think Harry thinks he is good at it. And that's my issue. I agree Riddle's good at it. I think Harry's like, oh, I do this a lot. And I recognize that, like, he's even better than me.
I don't know. I don't think think so, because just in these last chapters, he was so concerned about being caught on those stairs. He's not a mastermind of eloquence.
I agree. I don't think he thinks that, though.
I don't know. I think Harry has very little ego. I really do. I don't think so. We'll agree to disagree on that one.
We can come back to that when we get to those chapters, because I think he thinks he's a lot better at it than he is.
Yeah. He's also 2 years older and has been trying to get out of trouble a lot longer. He's also gotten out of trouble.
And he is better at it.
Yeah, he gets better. And also, the more times you get out of trouble, the more times you think you're good at getting out of trouble. Now, of course, we've talked about this at length in the first book and the second book, and we're continuing to talk about it. I don't think Harry's getting out of trouble because he's good at getting out of trouble. He's getting out of trouble because he's Dumbledore's puppet, and he has to get out of trouble so he can kill Voldemort, right? Has to build confidence. Either way, let's discuss as we see indications of if Harry thinks he's good at this or bad at this.
All right, we're keeping in mind.
So I'll ask another question, which is, it's just, you're begging to be asked. Begging to be asked. And I think we're going to disagree, which I like. Was Harry being dumb or noble when he stayed to see if all of the hostages underwater were collected by the champions?
He's being an idiot. He's being an absolute moron.
It's so funny, because I don't think that at all.
Seriously?
Not at all. Not the first time I read it, not the third time I read it, not the 100th time I read it.
I'm with Ron on this one, and I don't agree with Ron, like, ever. But I think Ron's right that Harry's being a moron.
Okay, so I think there are bits and pieces of our personalities that probably come out here. So we've discussed that I'm ambitious, but I'm not competitive. I don't care about winning or losing games. And so I think my fear would outweigh my wanting to win. Harry never cared about winning the Triwizard Tournament. The first time he ever thought about winning was like when he's in the middle of the third task. Like, he really was just trying to get out of it alive. And the last task was dragons. They could have easily killed him, right? Easily. He has no idea what's going to go wrong. Something's gone wrong every year he's been at this school. I think it says a lot about him that his fear of these people being hurt was more than his desire to win.
I don't think it's the competitive thing, though. I think I get what you're saying. I agree with a lot of it, but I don't look at it from the competitive standpoint. I look at it from the standpoint of, I think there's a difference between Harry can't figure out how to breathe underwater and he drowns to death, versus Dumbledore allowing Ron to drown to death because Harry couldn't complete the task. This is one of those instances where you give it another 10 seconds of thought, and it's like, yeah, Dumbledore's not going to allow Ron, Hermione, an 8-year-old Fleur Delacour, and Cho Chang to die because they were picked almost without their consent to be the person who's kept underwater in a charm. Like, there's no way harm's going to actually come to them. And I think there's a difference between harm coming to Harry and harm coming to Ron, and Harry's inability to recognize that the treasures were not any actual danger is really stupid.
Again, I don't disagree really, but I think had Harry planned and not procrastinated with his egg and had figured this out like several weeks before, a month before, he probably would have gotten to the point of like, well, they're not going to let him die. I mean, I think maybe he would have gotten there, but because he waited so long, I think he was just in panic mode. And I think that's when your true colors come out, and his true colors were, I saved all of them.
Sure, and I'll grant the point that he doesn't know until, you could say the morning of, or really 5 seconds before, what he has to recover. He doesn't know that he's going to have to recover Ron until Dobby says something, and he still doesn't really get it until the test started. So he doesn't have months to think about whether they're not going to let Ron drown. That's new. That's something he's not supposed to know until the moment of. So I'll grant that.
Right, and he didn't know it was people. So it could have been, like, his favorite book.
Could have been his Firebolt. He would never let that be underwater.
And he's like, okay, well, Crumb's favorite book can stay underwater. Nothing's going to happen. You know, but when it's people, I mean, that's his Achilles heel, is saving people. I don't see a world in which Harry would ever leave those people underwater, even if he thought it was probably going to be okay.
I hear you, I get you, and I understand why it's good. I understand the noble aspects of it. You know, I'm not saying it's bad. I just think that, like, logically, he could have very easily realized Gabrielle Delacour is not going to drown to death because Fleur didn't rescue her in time.
Okay, you're right. It's unreasonable to even suggest he wouldn't have done that, I think.
But I think we're having almost two very different conversations. You're saying emotionally, of course he can save them. And I'm saying, sure, but logically, he knows it's stupid. But, like, we know when emotions and logic come head to head, it doesn't always mean both sides win.
Well, just think, what would have happened if he was first going into the third task? He probably would have died in the graveyard himself, no Cedric. I mean, who knows what would have happened?
Sure.
It's dumb in terms of, like, the competition and not thinking it through. It was never going to do anything else.
Speaking of dumb and not thinking it through, love that transition there, all the champions have an hour to complete the second task. And we find out that Cedric, who is the first to return, comes back a minute after the hour. So none of the champions actually complete this task as they're expected or required to. None of them do it within the hour limit. So does that tell us about their abilities, or is that more just like, okay, this was a bad task when none of them actually did it by following the rules properly?
I think that's a really interesting question, and one that I actually don't think I've ever thought about, which is a great question, which leads me to the next question. Like, was someone trying it and seeing if they could do it in an hour?
Right.
It probably was too short of a time limit. I know they talked about it later in passing that, well, they put the hour time limit so you wouldn't dilly-dally down there acting like the hero or what, you know, whatever. But, I mean, I guess if Harry had gotten Ron and turned around, he would have been well under the hour.
Yes, and I knew you were going to say that because I already have my response prepared.
But didn't someone get rid of most of the mirror people or the...
I don't think so, but Myrtle essentially takes him there. Like, everyone else has to try to figure out where to go. Moaning Myrtle's like, oh, Harry, you go this way. He gets directions.
Yeah, but also, I mean, not that he's even that nice to Myrtle, but I don't even view this as that unfair because Cedric's been in Hogwarts his whole time, longer than Harry. He didn't make a friendship with Myrtle. Harry did. So if Harry gets to use that to find his way, then good for him. Good for Harry.
Fine. Point still being, though, none of them make it back within an hour.
Yes, I agree. No, we're being silly. I agree with you. It's an unreasonable task. It's unreasonable.
So I'm just not used to you agreeing with me.
Yeah, you don't even know what it sounds like. Yes, I agree. They should have made it like an hour and a half.
Right. Yeah, then they're all fine. Except for Fleur.
Right. And Fleur was never going to be okay.
Right.
She wouldn't have made it with any time. She got attacked going down.
So now that we've agreed on something, I want to go back to something we talked about a little bit because maybe we'll disagree again and we have to disagree. I don't like this agreeing thing. So we find out later in the books that it is Mad-Eye Moody / Crouch Jr. who stole the boomslang skin from Snape, that the intruder into Snape's store was Moody and not Harry, as Snape suspects. But when Snape accuses Harry and Harry's defending himself, in his mind he goes, actually, Dobby stole the gillyweed and Hermione stole the boomslang skin 2 years ago, so I didn't steal it. And I get why he's doing that, I get that's what he's thinking, but Harry knows that someone just broke in to the stores, and the boomslang skin that Hermione stole was 2 years ago. Is this another instance of, like, if Harry gave it another 10 seconds of thought, he would have realized that Snape's not talking about when Hermione stole ingredients and that someone else is making Polyjuice Potion?
Yeah, I think he was very frantic, right? Like, this was a very frantic period for Harry. He missed a trick step that he's been getting right for 4 years at this point. And that was before all this happened, right? I think either if he just had thought about it a little more calmly, he would have been like, that was a long time ago. Or if he had told Hermione about it, or even Ron, maybe one of them would have been like, that was a long time ago.
Right. I don't think he's calling you out on that.
Right. Someone would have said something. I mean, I think you're right. I think it got lost in the how crazy and worried and anxious Harry was in that moment. But we should have realized that too. And I don't think as a first-time reader, I realized that. I don't even think I had the thought. Oh, and I was sitting there not stressed out at all when I read it the first time. I missed that. Mm-hmm. But second reread, you couldn't miss it.
And I think actually that's one of the things that we talked in Prisoner of Azkaban, how great of a twist the Sirius is actually a good guy, Scabbers is the bad guy twist is, and it's an incredible twist. But in some ways, I think that's what makes Goblet of Fire's plot twist so incredible, that just in this chapter, in these three chapters alone, we've talked about, what, 4 or 5 different instances where we're getting the information. We're being told what we need to know to figure it out, but we can't.
We've said this in several of the episodes in Goblet so far, where we keep saying, all the plot is here. All the plot are in these chapters. All the plot are in these chapters, which makes preparing for the podcast challenging because you want to say everything. You don't want to miss one single bit. But you're right. It's really wild in this book. When you do it like this, when we're breaking it down chapter by chapter, you really can see it in a way you can't see it when you're just, you know, reading through them on vacation or whatever. They're just shouting at you what's going on all the time, but you take everything as you see it. So they tell you, Sirius says, and then the son died and the mom died shortly. Okay, great. Put it away. Perfect. Done. So when you're in that, and I can't wait to get there, when you're in that kind of explanation chapter, which how the hell are we going to cover it? I can't even begin to tell you. We're just going to have to read the book out loud, word by word. It's not like the serious plot where it's like, whoa, I didn't see, how was I supposed to figure any of that out? You really weren't. I mean, you weren't supposed to figure it out. When you go to the goblet climax, when you figure all this out, you're like, oh, I'm an idiot. Like, I should have pieced all this together.
And it's so funny because we talk about a lot of those types of examples, and I think they need to be talked about. But there are even ones we don't get to. So, like, a small one from these chapters is one of the things Sirius says is that Crouch was very harsh. He was very tough with suspected Death Eaters. And he compares him to Moody and says that Moody would only kill as a last resort. But earlier in this book, Moody showed them the killing curse on an innocent spider just to show them how it works. Like, you think about that, you go, okay, that's not something the real Mad-Eye Moody would have done. That's not the Moody that Sirius knows. And even those little ones like that, that, like, get so easily missed even on rereads because, like, it's being surrounded by so much more reveals, just adds to this pile of things. You're like, oh, wait a second.
Right. No, that's a great point. And actually, another one I hadn't really thought about, would the real Mad-Eye have done that? We'll really never know. I mean, we can only know based on what Sirius says. And we do, obviously, we get to know Mad-Eye a little bit. In a lot of respects, as the reader, a reader who's really into it, you feel like you know Mad-Eye because of this book, and you don't because it's not him.
Right.
But you feel like it's him because it acts like him.
Yeah, I mean, I think I already kind of gave my opinion away. I don't think he would have showed them the curses like that. But we don't know. But just another little thing that this book does incredibly, which piling on all this evidence that you don't realize that you took in.
Right. So I think we can conclude with one thought that I think we both wanted to talk about. Sirius doesn't seem to know about the dark mark, the tattoos. He seems very confused about the form. We keep hearing the arm over and over and over again this book. So who knows about them? Does anybody know about them? Does Dumbledore know about them? And I find it so hard to believe that this people wouldn't, it's on their arms. Like, how did people miss this the last time around? But it does not seem to be a generally understood sign.
Yeah, no, I agree. I do think Dumbledore must know about it because presumably Snape told him everything. So presumably Snape would have told Dumbledore about the Dark Mark. So Dumbledore must know. And we also know we get in flashbacks during Deathly Hallows of Snape telling Dumbledore that Karkaroth's mark is growing stronger. So we know that Dumbledore knows about the marks. It just seems so weird to me that I guess no one else in the Order does that, like, maybe Sirius wasn't the high player in the Order the first time around.
Yeah, he was young, and then he was gone. He was in Azkaban.
Right, where he might maybe would have had an opportunity to find out about it somehow.
How would you not have seen it?
Well, I guess they don't have, like, a prison yard where they play basketball or whatever.
Yeah, I guess.
But it does seem weird that, like, they have a tattoo that says, I am with Voldemort, and the good guys don't know about it.
And maybe they do. Like, maybe Remus Lupin knows about it. And we just don't know that he knows about it because he's not in these chapters. And he'd be like, oh, they're talking about the Dark Mark. I know all things about that.
Yeah.
It's possible that it was something that was discovered in between Voldemort trying to kill Harry when he was a baby and now, right? Probably a lot of things were turned over in that period of time. And maybe if you talk to Molly Weasley, she'd know. Or McGonagall. Or anyone at Kingsley, right? Kingsley probably know. He's an Auror.
I'm going to say, I think it makes a lot of logical sense what you're saying, but I'm going to say no. And I'm going to use Malfoy as the reason why not. Because if Aurors and the government knows about these tattoo, Malfoy's been accused of being a Death Eater every book, Lucius Malfoy, every book since we've learned about the character. Like, it'd be very easy for the government to be like, okay, just show us your forearm if you don't have a tattoo.
But Lucius Malfoy in the first war said he didn't have a choice. He was under the Imperius curse.
So he could have argued that they gave him a mark and he didn't want it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I don't like that argument.
Okay. No, that's fair. You're right.
And the only person that Harry brought up Malfoy, baby Malfoy's arm to in the sixth book was Dumbledore, who already knew about it. So I don't know that we ever figure this one out. Let's keep our eyes open for that one.
Yeah. No, I don't think we know the answer.
Let us know if you have any thoughts. Please connect with us on Twitter, Instagram, Gmail, Time Turner Pod. That's at everything. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to Julia, who does our amazing editing. I promise you, we do not sound this good when it's raw. And we look forward to seeing you next time.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. Make sure you get all those chickens for Sirius.